Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. There's a professor at Vanderbilt named Michael Bess who worries a lot about a trend he sees coming. It's our increasing ability to change our bodies. And I'm not talking about small changes here, like a nose job or a tattoo. We're talking about major, invasive, sometimes genetic changes to the way we look and the way we think. Bess has written a book about what he sees happening. And he says he used to believe that the talk of genetically modifying babies to make them good at sports or to change their eye color was ridiculous. Parents wouldn't want to fiddle with their kids before they were even born.
It's almost like putting them onto rails that you're sort of preempting many different possibilities, the openness of the development of a person. And I think some parents may feel comfortable doing that, but I think many would not. But there's a new domain of genetics that's in the past 5 years, maybe 7 or 8 years, has become increasingly exciting for biologists, and that's epigenetics. Epigenetic changes could be made at any point in a person's lifetime. And so you don't have the same issue of parents sort of forcing their children into a certain mold long before those children have become adults who can make choices for themselves. You can say, we can start making epigenetic changes after you're 21 years old, and then you can become sort of a genetic work in progress, sculpting your appearance, but also aspects of your personality and character over time. Epigenetic changes do not alter the underlying DNA, but they are the molecular mechanisms that affect how the DNA gets expressed or doesn't get expressed.
Okay, give me a sense of how this works, because it's really hard to conceptualize. I mean, I look a certain way, right? That's already, as far as I can tell, that's already sort of baked into the cake. How possibly, once I'm already born and maybe even I'm already grown up, how do I then start to fiddle with that and say, well, I don't actually want to look exactly this way? Or what kinds of things could you change?
Well, a very in a physical level, I'll take myself as an example. I really like to eat, and so I have a tendency to put on weight. So I'm constantly having to struggle and, you know, go on diets and stuff, and then I eat, and then I go back on diets, and that's I'm not alone in this. Now imagine that there were an epigenetic pathway that allowed me to alter the way I metabolize food, so that my metabolism is ratcheted up in certain ways or altered in certain ways, and I end up being able to eat whatever I want, as long as it's, you know, not just pure fat that's going to, you know, cause me to get very unhealthy, but eat whatever I want and not put on weight. That would be one example of an epigenetic modification. It's a small enhancement, but it nonetheless would affect the way I behave and in some ways the way I look.
Right. To dip back into that issue of designer babies for a second, how far off do you think we actually are from a point where parents will alter their children? I mean, probably with the best of intentions, just to kind of give them a leg up in the world. Because it seems like human nature to, you know, within your ability, help your kids out. And if that means making them a couple inches taller, that's probably what parents are going to try to do.
That's right. And they won't be able to make sure that it happens, but they'll probably within the next decade be able to start intervening in ways that increase the probability of it happening.
And do you think the government is going to allow that to happen, like to increase the probability that you're going to have, you know, a kid that's taller?
Well, I mean, the government will have to respond to what the majority of the population decides is ethical. And as long as the proper animal trials have been run and, you know, the side effects are recognized and are acceptable. Let's say, for example, that you discovered that a certain type of trout had a genetic ability to fend off cancer. That strikes me as the sort of alteration that many parents would be willing to make in their children at the moment of conception, if such a technology became possible, because you're not worrying then about what am I doing to the personality of my child. You're just giving them an immunity or a greater resistance to a terrible disease. And I think many parents would opt for that, just like vaccinations. That's the type of designer baby that I think is likely to become. Maybe 10 years is too soon. Maybe it's going to take 20 years or 25 years.
That still seems pretty soon.
That still seems pretty soon, especially compared to what we were thinking as recently as a decade or two ago.
Right.
And that could become a reality, and I don't see the government preventing that sort of thing. But obviously, if the parents are trying to make their kids into geniuses, and first of all, we don't fully understand, you know, all those mechanisms. In fact, we're still very far from fully understanding what intelligence exactly is, how it gets created in the brain, how the interaction between genes and environment contributes. But having said that, I keep being struck by how far we've already come and how rapidly the changes are taking place. In the 12 years that I've been following this closely, I keep being astonished by things that I thought were far away that are actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a constant experience of mine, which I guess brings me to the underlying message of the book, which is this is going to be tantalizing stuff. The temptation, the pressure is going to be great to go faster and faster and for people to try to adopt these things as quickly as they can. And my worry is that if we go too quickly and millions of people are adopting these kinds of modifications, there could be some terrible social, societal level effects.
Let's think through some of those effects. In some ways, the positive ramifications to somebody having a kid that's smarter or taller or can't get cancer is clear. But what are some of the more hidden effects or negative effects that we may not think about?
The metaphor I always use is the automobile. When you just take an automobile by itself, it's a fantastic technology that lets you go all over the place and increases your range of motion. And so as by itself, it's terrific. But then you look at what happens when millions of people adopt it, and you get sort of the evisceration of our cities as people move out to the suburbs. You get diseases spreading more quickly. You get traffic jams. You get dependency on foreign oil. You get pollution. All these unintended effects that happen when it becomes adopted at a mass scale. The same types of things can be expected to happen if millions of people start adopting a wide variety of these kinds of modifications, pharmaceutical, bioelectronic, epigenetic. The first thing that comes to mind is how expensive will they be, and will they only be accessible? Will the most potent modifications only be accessible to the wealthy?
Right.
Because then you start to say, well, if that's the case, then this will grievously exacerbate the gap between the haves and the have-nots in our society.
Well, you have almost a biological then splintering of the haves and the have-nots instead of just a monetary splintering, which you can always reverse monetary situations, but biology's harder to change.
That's right, much harder. So that suddenly the range of possibilities open to some people will be exponentially greater than the range of possibilities open to others. And that's even more troublesome when you look at it on a global scale, because within a society like the United States, that's a relatively wealthy society, we have tremendous disparities of wealth, but there's a greater degree of social mobility, at least compared to other parts of the world. But when you look at it on a global scale, then it becomes even more frightening. And I worry about that.
What would you say to somebody who says, yes, this will be different when we can start fiddling with biology, but to some degree, wealthy people already tend to marry wealthy people. You already have babies being born with unfair advantages over other babies. So, I mean, this is kind of just a minor extension of that.
I think that would be grossly underestimating how powerful these technologies will be. I suspect that in the beginning, modifications that people make to themselves will be modest in nature and minor, because most people would not be willing to perform, you know, radical experiments on their own body. Maybe some people will, but they'll be more the fringe. But over time, one can expect that the highly modified people will be able to run circles around unmodified people in all a manner of different kinds of capabilities, from cognitive abilities, but also all the way to how they interact with machines. And machines are going to become an increasingly integral part of our daily life. They already are, and they're going to become even more so. Now, imagine that you have the ability to interact with machines on a much more seamlessly integrated way. suddenly you have a whole different range of advantages that are opening up. And I frankly think, you know, if somebody has better memory, has a better ability to process information, if somebody isn't getting sick as often as other people, if somebody has the ability to stay focused for long periods of time and isn't as prone to emotional ups and downs, and you have two people who go and apply for a job, which one is going to get the job? Which one is going to have the opportunities? I think the highly modified people will run circles around those who are unmodified. And so I see a real potential gap there between two types of humanity, the unmodified and the modified. And that's another concern.
Take me for a minute to 2050, which is kind of far in the future, but not all that far, especially when you think about, you know, the next generation, people who are kids now, who are going to be in their 30s or 40s at that time. Do you feel like those, you know, that sort of generation of people in 2050, looking back on people today, will think, wow, those people were so much more simple than we are now?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that suddenly, I was actually writing my book and I suddenly looked up and it suddenly dawned on me, in the year 2100, it's possible that people like me today, unmodified, relatively unmodified humans, will be regarded in the same way as we today regard the Amish. That was a stunning realization, that people who are like us today will seem like quaint relics of a bygone era.
But I wonder if in some ways it seems like the separation will be even greater because the Amish are like us. They just don't have smartphones. I mean, they don't have the trappings that we have, but presumably if you take away, you know, my laptop and my smartphone and stuff, I'm not actually that different from an Amish person.
Yes. No, you're right. And I mean, I think I'm referring also to the voluntary simplicity that the Amish have chosen to infuse their lives as a way of thinking of the comparison. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what we're talking about is a very much broader range of capabilities and functions that the unmodified and the modified will tend to diverge over the decades to the point where I think our ability to think about it in science fiction has sort of been lagging behind. There's a famous movie called Gattaca where the main character is able by sheer willpower to elevate himself up to the level of those who have been genetically modified and compete with them and function at the same level as them. And I thought it was a fascinating movie, but I thought, in a way, it's not even fully exploring the implications of the premise of genetic engineering, because what I'm thinking of is a world where those who are genetically modified are operating in a way that no unmodified person can ever hope to approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, the Gattaca movie struck me as unrealistic or implausible.
So big picture here, would you say you're more excited or more worried about this future that you think about in terms of how we will actually physically change ourselves, not the stuff around us,
right?
Ourselves.
50-50. And it also sort of varies on which aspect I'm looking at. I think I would adopt many of the modifications that I describe in my book as plausible possibilities coming down the line. For example, rejuvenation. I'm 60 years old, and I would love certain kinds of rejuvenation, and I think I would cautiously move toward adopting those. I'm scared to death when I think about some of the societal effects that could be coming over the horizon if our society doesn't proceed with caution and humility in adopting these technologies. So at one level, I think they're tantalizing and extremely exciting. The possibility for the broadening of our experience and our capabilities is remarkable, and I'm looking forward to seeing that happen. I wish I could live long enough to see it all. And on the other side, I'm terrified for what my children and their children are going to face, because some of these challenges are going to be truly unprecedented.
Michael Bess is the author of Our Grandchildren Redesigned, Life in the Bioengineered Society of the Near Future. He's a professor of history at Vanderbilt. Michael, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.